to get squirrely.
4, 3, 2, 1, boom. I got to ask Donnie Vincent who made that knife because people always ask me about it.
It's awesome. I could have used it on Saturday.
When the shit got squirrely at the UFC? Yeah. With the side that you guys were on, where you guys were in the crowd, did anybody jump towards you that way?
No, the crowd mainly started. Yeah, it was because I'm pretty sure we had Irish right in front of us, and right in front of them was some of Khabib's guys. And Khabib's guys were turning around, just literally throwing the fingers right to the Irish guys the whole time. So then once that happened, it was like, I was lucky though. I had Aubrey and Whitney right there.
They were there to protect you.
Yeah, they were in full throwdown mode. I was one of the dumb people just kind of looking around like,
they were going to throw mushrooms at everybody.
Yeah, is there any immediate danger? No. Obviously it seemed way worse over on your side, but I was more worried when they made us leave. Because the further up you got in the bleachers, and once you got out into the concession area and in the bathrooms, that's where stuff was going down. Like, just people from the crowd, guys with Irish flags all obviously were getting trash talked to them. And there was a big brawl
right next to me on the other side from where they were sitting.
Oh, that's right. There was one just to our right. I was looking left.
I believe it was the guy that jumped in the red shirt on Khabib's team. When they were trying to leave, when they were getting them out, people in the crowd were like, ah. They start throwing shit at them first. Like, that's how that's where the first shit was getting thrown down.
And how did people know that it was them?
We all saw him.
We could see
the guy next to me. He was like, "That's the guy. That's the guy right there." Right? And I was like, "I don't know." And he went and tried to do something. And I was like, "Good luck. I don't know what you're doing, bud."
You know, there's a price to be paid for all this shit. Like all the drama and the trash talking that makes it so fun. It also, you know, it has the potential for blowing up in your face. Ultimately, like, a couple people got punched. But it was in an event where a bunch of people got punched. You know what I mean? It's like
way more than that. It was awesome.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying? It's like we made it seem, it seemed like it was way worse than it really was, because in any other situation, it would be way worse than it really was. Like if it was a rock concert and some dudes just from, you know, like, you know, if one band was the opening band and then there was another band that was in a brawl with them and they were the main event. And then the fans of one band threw down with the fans of the other band and beat the shit out of each other. That would, for whatever reason, be way worse than when it's at a fight. Because if it's at a fight, it's just fighters. Oh, I saw this. The insane clown.
Same time.
This was going on. This insane clown posse guy tried to drop kick Fred Durst. Fred Durst wasn't even looking at him. Running head start and misses. And look at him. He turns around. He's like, what? And he just kept going.
I haven't seen Fred.
And then they dragged that dude off. I mean, that is maybe the worst public dropkick in the history of the world.
I think they meant he dropped when he tried to kick.
Well, he tried to. That was a classic dropkick. Yeah. Classic pro wrestling dropkick. But his problem is he threw it like a pro wrestler would, where you don't really hit the guy. You know, I mean, he just kind of touched him. And if Fred was playing along, it would have been awesome.
Yeah, we need a slow-mo replay.
Fred would have went flying, and it would have been, you know, fuck.
I think a lot of the thing that's going through people's minds, too, is when you're at a fight like that, there's a lot of people in the crowd that can throw down.
Yes.
It's not like, you know, you go to a hard rock concert of any kind, Clay Guida is going to be there somewhere, obviously. But as long as you can avoid Clay, like, your opportunity of finding a guy that can really throw cuffs is going to be way smaller than when you're at the UFC and you look around. It's hard not to see cauliflower ear.
Yeah.
So, I mean, someone who's in the crowd that's just a shit talker, he knows if I just turn around and talk shit, I could get wrapped up and be dead quick.
Yeah, that's a very high number of people that could fuck you up at one of those events. It's probably like 30%. 30% of the people in the audience actually know how to fight. That's high.
I think it'd be higher at a UFC.
Yeah.
At least a basic.
I think it's about 30. I'd say about 30%. I feel like if you just like parse the audience out, like how many of you guys have ever been punched? How many guys ever fucked somebody up? How many guys actually train? How many guys know how to train and like do it on a regular basis? How many guys are in shape? Like if shit went down, how many guys could actually throw down for a solid 30 seconds?
Yeah, that's where you that's where I would shine. I'm going to ride this out for 2 minutes, and then these giraffe elk legs are getting ready to freaking start dancing on some people. Let some people spaz out for a little while, and then I'm good.
People don't, you know, when people were talking about Connor and his conditioning for this fight, like one of the things that Cam Haynes said was like, you know, he needs to start running, like go run in the hills. I'm like, that ain't gonna help. Like, I mean, it would help some, but the thing is, when someone's wrestling you and they're on top of you, fucking you up like that, you're just getting drained. It's like a vampire just sucking blood out of you. Like,
yeah,
you're exhausted. You're carrying all their weight, and you're getting beat up, and you're stressed. And, you know, you're trying to move and you can't breathe well because the person's weight is on top of you. So you're not getting like real breaths and you're constantly resisting their weight. And it's way easier for them than it is for you. It's way easier to stay on top than it is to be on the bottom. It's a disaster.
Well, people that grew up wrestling, you know, you look at Miller, Mendez, Guida, those guys have experienced that forever. Like, yeah. It's ingrained in them. Most wrestlers don't lose like a classic wrestling physique, even as adults. They still look like they were guys that were real athletic at one time. You know, I remember one of the first things my dad taught me, you know, when I was younger in school, he's like, I think it was after the first guy, you know, wanted to fight me on the playground. He's like, you know, if you don't know if the guy's good at fighting, don't worry about it. Unless he's a wrestler, he's like, just, if it's a wrestler, try to back down, because he's like, you don't know what to do.
Smart dad.
And yeah, it was classic this weekend when I was watching that fight. I'm like, okay, here we go. This is just a classic. He's going to, you know, Connor had like 30 seconds at the start of those rounds, and then it was just a mauling. You know?
Yeah, well, John Kavanaugh, who's Connor's trainer, will be here next. He's going to be here at 11, and we'll get a chance to talk to him and see what the fuck he thinks and what happened. And the bottom line is that guy is so much better than him as a grappler. So much better.
Yep.
He is on such a high level. When I talked to Daniel Cormier says that guy schools world-class wrestlers in the gym, just throws people around.
Yeah, assassins. Yeah. Like probably one after another.
Yeah, he's special talent. He's been wrestling since he was a little kid, man. I mean, he really has. You ever see the video of him wrestling a bear?
No, but I want to.
You never saw it?
No, but I want to.
It's fucking hilarious. It's him wrestling a brown bear. It's like a small brown bear. Like a Russian brown bear. Like our version of a grizzly in Russia. And he's fucking wrestling
it. So you're saying
like
a coastal peninsula bear?
Yeah.
Like a peninsula?
Yeah, look.
What is
happening?
Yeah,
that's him when he's a little kid. Look at this. I mean, who the fuck lets their kid wrestle a bear? And the bear's biting him. Look at this bear's biting his clothes. Bear's a total cheater, which prepared him for Connor this weekend because Connor did a lot of cheating.
Okay. Look, if I would have saw this, I would be making a bet.
He gave up position because of the bite. See that? He was on top, and the bear bit him, and he let the bear get on top. Now he's on top.
Yep, it's over.
Look at this. But it's not. Bears are squirrely, man, and bears have a really good guard.
Oh, look at that. Yeah, look at the double leg.
He's laughing.
That's awesome.
Him. That's him as a little boy. Look at that, 1997.
See, we can't do that stuff in America.
I know. That's why we're going to lose.
Imagine if Mendez got to go out and just wrestle bears.
Look how little he is, too. I mean, he's a little kid there, man. He looks like he's about 8 years old.
Actually, I think in the neighborhood I grew up with the Guidas, they probably had one of these in their garage.
A bear?
Yeah, Clay and Jason. They were both kind of nuts. Maybe they did wrestle some bears.
What state was that?
It was in Illinois.
So that
Northern
would be a
Illinois,
black bear?
Johnsburg. Yeah, probably. This is awesome.
It's crazy. You know what's interesting? I've been...
Why doesn't he bite back? Didn't get that training.
Yeah, don't do that, because then the bear's really going to get into it. Look at the bear's trying to bite his head and shit. Well, it's just a little bear.
But his dad just, like, let him ride it out. He's good.
Well, the bear is obviously being nice. They're having fun. I mean, even that was the bear. You know, it's like when a dog is biting you when you're playing with them, and they're not trying to hurt you.
Look at that.
But the bear is also on a chain, which is kind of fucked up because the bear can't circle
correctly. I mean, that bear.
Look at that guard.
Very good.
Bears have a very good guard. Look at this. He shoots it low. I mean, Russians are a fucking different breed, man.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
A different breed. And as things are hard over there, we try to make things softer and softer over here. We're giving kids participation trophies. We don't want bullying.
They're like, we're bringing a grizzly into the assembly, and we're going to wrestle grizzlies today.
Yeah, how old are you? 8, and you haven't wrestled a grizzly yet? What are you, a pussy?
Yeah, here we
Come
go.
On. Yeah.
Couple shots of vodka, grizzly bear.
Well, you're seeing a lot of very, very tough guys come from that part of the world.
Yeah.
And they're fighting in combat
Not
sports
just guys.
Now. Yeah, women, yeah.
Not just guys.
Yeah.
And as much as we're talking about wrestling, he impressed me stand up.
Like, oh yeah, he cracked Connor with that big right hand.
He stood up enough to just say, you know, I'm going to sit here and take a few, and I'm going to give a few. But then he went to probably what his game plan was, I would assume.
Well, you have to stand for a little while because if he just shoots in, he'll get caught with a knee or caught with a punch rushing in. But he landed the bigger shot. There was one big, giant shot that was landed in that fight, and it was by hand.
Yeah.
I mean, Connor hit him with some pretty good front kicks to the body and some other things, but didn't really get much off on the feet.
Not like classic left jabs that just break people down.
Yeah. And on the ground, I mean, he just got mauled. And it's one of those things where you see that guy. In the beginning, guys fight him off a little bit, and then as the fight wears on, he just gets more and more dominant. They get more and more exhausted. Really, this fight just makes Ally Aquinta look like a god. I mean, that's the most impressive thing about it. Ally Aquinta went 5 rounds with him, stood toe-to-toe with him, and, you know, gave him at least a struggle. At least he gave him a bit of adversity.
Yep.
You know, managed to survive on the ground much better than Connor did, managed to get back up to his feet, managed to stuff a bunch of takedowns, and on the feet was a real threat. You know, I mean, obviously, Khabib didn't prepare for Ally Aquinta. He prepared for Connor. But Ally Aquinta didn't even prepare for 5 rounds. He only prepared for 3. So there was so much to that fight.
What do you think will happen with Connor now?
I'm worried what happens with Khabib.
Yeah.
I hope they sit everybody down and they go, look, everybody's all right. Come on.
Yep.
You know? So
yeah.
The guy who rushed in the cage and punched Connor in the face... That guy should be in the most trouble. Because, you know, the guy just fought 4 rounds, got the fuck beaten out of him, got choked. I heard a lot of people, there's a lot of silly non-experts out there saying that that wasn't a choke or that wasn't a neck crank. They don't know what the fuck they're talking about. That is absolutely a neck crank. When someone gets their arm around your head like that, and then what they do is they grab it like this, and they pinch the elbow, they put the forearm on his back like this. So as the arm is across the neck, and then they grip it like this, and the forearm goes into the back, and as you're pulling like this, you're pushing with your forearm and yanking with your hand. It is a terrible neck crank. They call it, Dean Lister actually has a video on it. He calls it the fulcrum choke, and it's a nasty choke. So, you know, I thought he was going under the neck. Here, you can see it here. Dean Lister, who's a world champion, Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, and that's my friend Hans Mollenkamp behind him. Now, watch how he does this. See how he's grabbing a hold of it, and what he's going to do is he's going to clamp his hands. See how he grips his hands?
Yep.
And so
it crushes
he's doing
esophagus.
It like this. No. You can go right over your face. It can go over your neck. It can go over your face. It can go over your fucking cheekbones. It doesn't matter. It doesn't even have to go under the chin. If it goes under the chin, that's awesome. But you see what's going on with his forearm?
Yeah.
See how he's pulling with
leverage.
His arms?
Yeah. Lever arm.
Or you could do it. Some guys do it like this, but I think this is probably the best way to do it. But as you're right here, this part just digs that elbow. Yeah, perfect. Perfect example. See, he's pulling on it with his right arm, and then his left arm is pushing down with his forearm on Connor's shoulder. It is a nasty, nasty neck crank. And your head is getting popped off. And first of all, that guy could squeeze the shit out of you. All you have to do, there's a bunch of guys who could put you to sleep like that. Marcelo Garcia's one. He puts guys to, he's put guys to sleep without even getting under the chin. He just gets your head. Just gets your head in there and squeezes. Eddie Bravo can do that too. If he gets your head in there, you don't even have to, it doesn't even have to be under the chin. He just really puts you to sleep with your own fucking head. Just wraps it around your head and squeezes it so tight that no blood is getting to your brain. Yeah, so there's a lot of armchair quarterbacks out there saying that that was a neck crank. You're incorrect. And have Dean Lister do that shit to you, and you will know.
I'm pretty sure I had Jocko do that to me. My throat is still.
You don't want that.
No.
Why were you rolling with Jocko? That is a terrible idea. Well, why did he do that to you? What did you do to him?
I don't know.
You were just trying to learn, right?
Yeah, I was trying to learn, and I, you know, he said, "Well, who wants to roll?" And I just said, "Me."
Yeah.
And he kind of just looked at me. He's like, "Well, just try to do something."
But you're taking classes now, right? You're taking 10th
when I can. Yeah. I've got one in Altoona, Iowa. So thanks to you and Eddie for hooking me up with Damien.
Shout out to Damien. What's super important is drilling. That's the most important thing in the beginning. It's sort of like there's parallels in archery for sure, because archery, what's really important is your technique. Your technique is almost everything, like doing everything correctly. And that's the same thing with jiu-jitsu, same thing with Muay Thai, Taekwondo, anything. It's just technique and doing it over and over again correctly until it's ingrained in your system.
Yeah, it's information overload for sure. That's one of the hardest parts for me, is I'm so new at it that I feel like my cognitive functioning is not at a level to take in. I mean, there's so much going on. And several people have told me, they're like, there comes a point where all of a sudden it something clicks and you start to comprehend everything. But until that moment happens, it's, you know, you're going to struggle to remember what you talked about last time or how to do it exactly right. But eventually there comes a time when it clicks and it starts to, you know, you do start to soak in stuff, and I'm definitely not to that point yet. I mean, just even some of the basic drills. The one thing I do understand that they were impressed by is just leverage on joints, you know, because they were talking about some of the different arm bars and stuff. You know, they were like, well, if the elbow's like this, and I said, yeah, that won't work. The elbow has to be like this. And I remember Damien looked at me like, how do you know that? And I'm like, you know how many arms I've dissected off animals? You know, if you have to knock four hooves off a elk quarter to pack it out, if you don't know where the joint is and how to bend it and hit it just right to crack that off.
That's a good point.
And, you know, hips, shoulders, even taking the head off. I mean, you know.
I think that too, but also your understanding of like the proper positioning of your shoulders and your elbow and everything in archery.
Yeah.
I think just an understanding of the human body alone, you know, I think that helps you tremendously. It's one of the reasons why people that are really good at gymnastics excel at jiu-jitsu. People are really good at breakdancing.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, breakdancers excel. Yoga, a lot of yoga people.
Yep.
They get really good at yoga. They can excel at jiu-jitsu too. It's just you have just an understanding of what the way your body moves.
And mind-body just connection, like being able to really have a mind-muscle connection. Some people don't understand that. You tell them to do a pull-up, and you're like, you really want to use lats, and they're like, well, what's that?
Yeah, they don't know. They're just yanking.
Just pulling. And some people, when they pull a bow for the first time, even big guys, they struggle pulling a bow because their technique's poor. So they're lifting up high and they're pulling all with bicep down. And it's like, man, can you just lift up and go straight back with, you know, just certain muscles of the back? And when they see it, they're like, how do you do that? And it's just understanding of leverage and muscle. And then once they understand that flow, it gets really easy. But until that, it looks like they're trying to literally do a max rep.
It's that too, but it's also you probably have done it a million times. So your arms are so conditioned to do that. It's such a natural movement.
Probably more than a million. Yeah. I would say probably several.
Well, here's a perfect example I use. Most people, even if they have like a strong left arm, like if I go, hey, flex your arm, you see a good left bicep, you know, you look like you got good shoulders in your left hand. And then I bring you to a heavy bag and I say, throw a left hook. Most people's left hooks are fucking dog shit. Just straight up dog shit.
Yeah, I
try to get someone to throw it. They're like, it just doesn't work. It doesn't
listen.
It's
like having someone throw a baseball left-handed. It just looks terrible.
It's even worse. I think you might be able to throw, because the concept of throwing seems normal, but the concept of digging in with your toes and turning your body into a hook, and then if you do it and you just do it slowly, just bang, and hit a bag, they're like, how are you doing that? And you just like you just get used to it. For the long when I was striking all the time, my left bicep was quite a bit larger than my right one. My left arm was actually stronger than my right because you're always jabbing. And hooking, and you're throwing less right hands than you are left hands. And so my left side was bigger. Like my left arm, I had a bit, like I could see it. Like if I flexed the two of them together, my left bicep looked larger. And that's a normal thing with boxers. If you're not a person who switches stances and you keep yourself in an orthodox stance with your left leg forward, you'll have a stronger left hand. Like I would be able to open things better with my left hand than my right hand. Isn't that weird?
Well, I mean, yeah, you're turning so much too. So I mean, I guess when you're snapping back, you're kind of supinating the when you come back, right?
I think it's just the use, just the sheer number. Like if you looked at like a really good boxer, left hand versus right hand, you might throw 2-1, maybe 3-1,
three to one left hand, maybe.
You throw a lot, yeah. If you're doing it right, you know, you're supposed to be jabbing more than you are just throwing haymakers.
Well, one of the highlights of the fight, there were several. Ferguson's match was amazing.
Ferguson's incredible.
I mean, incredible.
Dude, that guy had catastrophic knee surgery. Like his knee was so blown out, they were not sure if he was going to be able to fight again. They were like, I don't know what's going to happen here, because he had ripped his tendon completely off the bone. The scar on his leg is enormous. His scar is like 12 inches long. It's a fucking massive scar. So they had to open him up like a fish, and then they have to get in there, and they have to bolt down that ligament to the bone.
Were they able to use the same one, pull it back down?
Yeah. He had surgery almost immediately after the injury. He didn't have to have a cadaver or anything like that.
Yeah.
And the way they do it, I honestly don't know exactly what was involved, but look at that knee. Look at the fucking knee, man. That's incredible. That is incredible. And then 6 months later, he's not just healed up. He's got Anthony Pettis kicking that leg.
Yeah.
We were very concerned in the beginning of the fight. It looked like he got hurt on that leg because Pettis hit that leg twice really hard, and it looked like he was wobbly a little bit on that leg.
Yeah, I was going to say he survived a catastrophic flurry.
Yeah.
I mean,
Pettis caught him.
Yeah, and he came back big time because it didn't look good. There were several fighters that dug really deep that were in trouble and came back for some awesome comebacks.
How about Derek Lewis?
Mm-hmm. He's the best.
He's the best ever.
Yeah, he's my official favorite now. I love that.
That fucking post-fight interview is my favorite post-fight interview ever.
For sure.
I go, Derek, why'd you take your shorts off? My balls was hot.
I love that.
How about what he said? I got a phone call before the fight. Donald Trump called me and said, I got to knock this Russian motherfucker out and make it everybody look bad with all this Putin shit.
I was in the crowd, and I'm like, I looked at Sharon, and I go, did he say his balls were hot? She's like, she goes, I think he did.
In the crowd, I don't think, appreciated as much as the people back home. It was hard to hear.
Yeah.
But the people back home, they got it straight from his mic into their TV. They got the full version of it.
Yeah, it was muffled pretty hardcore.
He is so classic. He's so funny, man. And what a fucking puncher. Holy shit. Holy shit can that guy crack.
Because
he was down as you can get. I mean, he's basically three rounds in the hole. And 30 seconds to go. Boom! boom. And we were saying that we were saying it in the commentary that he still has the kind of power where one shot could win the fight.
Yeah.
And people are like, yeah. But is he going to land? Boom! He lands it.
That's what's hard about being live at the fight. You don't really get the commentary. And your guys' commentary is so good when you're watching on pay-per-view. It's dissecting so many things that you aren't, you know, unless you're very seasoned at watching MMA, you don't appreciate a lot of that stuff. And when you're watching with no one's opinion, you're kind of just watching and waiting for something like that to happen, where there's a lot of times you guys are calling that. You're seeing some of that stuff that needs to happen or should happen. And
they used to have this thing that you could get. I don't think they have it anymore. It was like a little FM radio. Did you see it at the...
I haven't seen it in a while.
No, I don't think they have it anymore. But it used to be a little thing that you would buy at the gift shop. It's like a little, and it doubled as an FM radio. So if you used it, like it still would work somewhere else as a radio. But when you keep it on a certain frequency, they would broadcast the commentary. So you would get the commentary, and you could keep it in your ear while the fight was going on.
Yeah, that is one of the things that's missing just a little bit.
Yeah, but it's just, there's something about being in the building.
Especially that one.
Yeah.
There was just electricity, radiating from person to person in the crowd. It was electric.
Yeah, that was probably the biggest UFC of all time. I mean, it has to be one of them. You know, they don't know.
They won't
know for another day or so. But I think it's the most important fight of all time, because Conor being such a huge superstar and then being out of MMA for two solid years and then Khabib just being so dominant, 26-0. And then there was also like the controversy of like how he won the title. You know, he won the title last minute. He was supposed to be fighting Tony Ferguson. Tony gets injured. Al Iaquinta steps up, and it's for the title. And everybody's like, what? How is that for the title?
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing was just very, very weird.
If there's not a rematch, which you would think numbers-wise there has to be.
I don't think so. I wouldn't think there'd be a rematch. Not for a long time.
Well, what's awesome is if there isn't, and kind of the counter politics are out of that weight class, now some of the fights we'd get to see, like I'd love to see him in Ferguson, would be
Ferguson's the fight.
Yeah.
That's the fight 100% now.
Yeah.
After Ferguson dominated Pettis like that and then also overcame that big shot where he got hurt.
Yeah.
I don't want to see McGregor versus Khabib again. No. I don't think it's going to be any different.
There's so many more that would just be awesome.
I would like to see it in the future. I mean, but Conor would have to do something to show that he, first of all, there is absolutely a factor in that he had not been fighting for 2 years.
Yeah.
One boxing match in 2 years is just not good enough. For MMA, especially with wrestling, just not good enough. And then I think he would have to, like, really, really concentrate on his wrestling. And even that, I mean, how much better can he get?
Dude, honestly, that guy was wrestling a bear as a kid.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's so much better.
Yeah, he's going to have to go back in time and rethink this.
I mean, Khabib might just have his number for life. You know, that's what Cormier said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking to Cormier after the fight. He was like, listen to me, he's never going to beat him. Never. He's never going to beat him. I go, you don't think he could ever get to the point where he'd get his takedown defense up enough? He's like, it'll never happen. He's never going to get there. He's too far away.
He's got to get a clean one shot that just ends it. That would be it.
Yeah, that would be
It's like that in my field, too. I mean, I guess I stay honed, but I'm not like razor sharp in my field.
You mean target archery? Like if you're going to compete?
Yeah, people all the time say, why don't you compete? And it... Can I shoot better than most people at this point? Yeah, you know, I can answer that without question. Can I shoot could I have beat myself when I was shooting on the teams? No way. Like, that was a different person. And when I stepped away for 2 or 3 years, even though I contemplated coming back, I'm like, this commitment is going to take a year, 2 years of really fine tuning. Because, I mean, at those levels, people don't miss. you know, so missing one or two still means it's a burnt weekend. It's still a burnt tournament. Like, you have to be flawless. And if you're not flawless, then all you're doing is donating money.
And when you compete in those tournaments, what's the distance?
It depended. There's several different formats, anywhere from 18 meters, which you were shooting at something the size of a dime. And most of those, you know, like a 600 round, you would need to be, you know, then I was shooting like, you know, upper 590s at something the size of a dime.
Explain what that means.
So, like, to hit that X the size of a dime is a 10. So you would have to, you know, literally
60 times.
Yeah, out of 60 arrows in tournament play, you would have to hit that dime, you know, 57 times. And then, you know, when we went out to the longer distances, up to 90 meters, I mean, you have to be shooting something a little bit larger than the end of that coffee cup. You know, you'd have to be deadly accurate with that thing. I mean, you're going to have to be in the high 90 percentile of being able to hit that.
And you also get used to the competition. You get sharper because your mind's in that place.
Well,
you're there all the time.
That's the hardest part. Even if you're on the game, which there's been times like this past summer, I had a event that I did for a Cabela's experience where some of the Cabela's Black Signature Card members kind of, I guess, bought an experience, and I did some training at the Easton Center with them, and then we went and shot the Total Archery Challenge in Utah, and, you know, I talked through the technicalities of what you would do on each shot.
Explain what the Total Archery Challenge is for people.
Total Archery Challenge is a tournament it's not even a tournament, it's more of a fun event where it's in Snowbird, and they set archery targets like in real hunting situations, but with very, very technical shots, extreme angles, longer distances. You got crosswinds and canyons.
And Snowbird, for people who don't know, is a ski course.
Yep.
What is that?
Sorry. I actually had the video.
And, it's just very technical because the footing's poor.
Oh, here it is.
Yeah, this is...
this is the Total Archery Challenge. So it's really interesting because it's in the summertime, but it's at a ski place, ski range. What would you call it? What would you call it?
Yeah, it's
ski
a...
Ski course?
It's at a ski lodge, yeah.
Yeah, but
it's
where the
slopes?
It's
slopes.
Literally a resort, yeah. It's Snowbird.
So you take the ski lifts up to where these things are, and these targets are all set up, and there are all these foam deer and foam sheep and all these different game animals, and they're at extreme distances and with weird angles.
You take the tram all the way to the top of the mountain. And then you literally shoot down. I think it was about 6 miles for us to get down. I think our total walk one day was about 6 miles. But I shot it with this group and taught them the technicalities of it. And because of that, I really wanted to be prepared. I knew that there was going to be people there watching. I knew that because I stepped into an actual event where there were a few thousand archers there, I knew that there was going to be a lot of people watching me because I haven't gone out into like that realm in a while. It would be no different than if all of a sudden, you know, you were out of MMA for a while and then went in there.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be eyes on you. So I just wanted to be on my game, or as best as I could be. So I set a goal. I'm trying to think what it was. I think I set a goal of like, I think it was around 10,000 arrows I wanted to shoot prior to that. So
over a course of
just a few months, yeah. I mean, I think the one day I shot around 500 a day. I think I time-lapsed one of those. I don't know if you remember that. But once you go there, even if you're totally on your game, if you have to shoot with other guys that are elite-level athletes, there's still a lot that goes into it. I mean, and especially if you're shooting for score, you're shooting for money, those pressure factors, if you're not acclimated to them, those aren't things that you can just step back into. When I was my best as a competitor, my practice was almost at tournaments every weekend. It was, I mean, 40 something events a year, you know, every 3 days you're at a tournament in the heat of the moment with the best five or six people in the world. And then you go home for a few days, you repack, you retune, and then you're right back in the grind again.
Somebody got stripped of a title because they tested positive for THC and beta blockers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is real recent, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When I competed, you're depending on what level you're at, there was, because I shot with the U.S. team, certain tournaments didn't have doping. And then, but when you shot anything that was on a world level, you did. So I was always in a doping pool. So, you know, it was no different than like when I was with Chad Mendez at a turkey hunt.
You mean a testing pool?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they would test your blood or your urine. What would they test?
Either one. Yeah. And you would be on call. You'd have to let them know.
Have you ever tried beta blockers? What is that? What do they do? You ever tried it?
Well, no. It's supposed to
kills your nerves, right?
I would think it blocks adrenaline.
Yeah.
Right? The ability for your brain to dump adrenaline. So, yeah, the number one thing in archery or any type of finesse sport is, you know, low heart rate, keeping your heart rate down, because that's obviously keeping your mind in the game, and stability, very minimal movements. So, yeah, there's I remember I had a coach a long time ago. He talked about alcohol and how alcohol could help shooter, because we were talking about a guy that had done well at tournaments several times, and I said, yeah, he always does good. And he said, yeah, he's always drunk. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he said, well, he goes, if you play alcohol the right way and you're like not sloppy drunk, but you're he just like stays in his zone and he's just kind of sitting there drinking the whole time. And that was but like prior to where they were testing for alcohol. So he actually made us, he said, all right, well, let's see how you do if you shoot when you have a buzz going. So, you know, we drank and shot. And, you know, don't try this at home, kids. it wasn't an archery range where they have to buy insurance or whatever. But, yeah, and that was part of it. Because at the time, this was in the mid-90s, another archer that had won a bunch of titles also tested positive for beta blockers and had some titles stripped. But then for the longest time, that was one of my complaints, was once I was shooting at a level with the teams and we had to go through testing or be if, for example, at an event when I medaled, if you're in the top three, immediately you get tested. I mean, so that's how it is. So you know, everyone there is level. They're all level. But then you go to other events, like, for example, some of the biggest money events were the 3D shoots, and that was a big reason why I left those shoots, because at those tournaments, there was no testing. There was no testing. There was clearly guys there that were shooting that were kind of just out of it. There could be $50,000 on the line, and there was just not a sweat cracked. Because they're, you know, some of that stuff, obviously, it is a performance enhancer because of the fact they're not having to deal with adrenaline spikes and accelerated heart rate.
For people who don't know what we're talking about, 3D shoots are a type of tournament where they have those realistic-looking targets. So foam elks or a foam bear, and they have areas that you're supposed to hit.
Yeah, and the other thing was I didn't like the fact that at that time – when you scored, it was just based off if there's four guys in a group, whatever the majority voted, that's how it's scored. And when there's a lot of money on the line. So, like, say you shot and I shot, Jamie shot and Sharon shot. We'd walk up and, you know, they're foam rings. So the arrow could look like it's in, it could look like it's out, but it's not a clear line. And we would just, if me, you, and Jamie said that's out, then even if Sharon's was close, it'd be out. So I was in some groups where things got a little shady. People were wanting to make money, and it got apparent that it wasn't, you know, there wasn't a judge there calling every score, which on a world level, there's judges there.
Oh, so if you guys were all competing against each other, you would call for each other?
I've seen groups where they did.
Oh, that's calm.
Yeah.
That's wacky.
Yeah. I've seen groups where they did.
You ever try beta blocker?
No.
I want to know what that's like. I'd like to do something nerve-wracking. Try a beta blocker and then do something fucking really nerve-wracking.
Can me and Andy throw you out a plane?
No.
Please. No. I think you would like it.
Whether I'd like it or not, it's not happening.
Well,
I'm not interested.
It doesn't get much sketchier than that roller coaster we were on yesterday.
Yeah, we did the roller coaster at New York. Oof. Sketch City. That thing felt like it was tied together with bubble gum. I couldn't
tape,
believe how rickety it was.
Floss.
It feels so uncomfortable. You're like, wait a minute, this is just way. It's old. It's outside. Everything's outside. You're flying around the casino itself, like, and the whole thing just feels like it shouldn't be there.
Yeah, I think there's several things there that are a little outdated.
Yeah,
yeah. I was one row behind you guys, and I was next to this kid who had never ridden a roller coaster, and he was terrified. Like, he was terrified, and I thought, have I just not been on one of these long for that long to where this feels like it could possibly shake off and we could launch on, like...
When was the last time a roller coaster did break loose? Like, when was the last time someone...
There's something last year, I believe, that happened.
Something happened last year?
Yeah, let me see.
Don't show them.
Mm. When those carnivals roll into town,
yeah.
That's on you. If you get on one of those fucking things... I was at one... a couple of years back, and I took a picture of it for Instagram because there was this one of those whirly wind things. Oh, roller coaster derails. Two riders fall 30 feet to the ground at Daytona Beach. Oof. Oh, don't show me this.
I think that's just afterwards.
Oh, that's it? Hanging?
Yeah, I don't think they got the live video.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, woof.
Daytona Beach. But that's Florida. See, anything that's fucked up could happen in Florida. I guarantee the guy who was fixing that's on OxyContin. He's probably got a python in his pocket. Fucking assholes.
They need one of those in a Buc-ee's. Do they have a roller coaster in a Buc-ee's yet?
No, they don't.
But they need one.
Does Texas is not known for roller coasters. They're a little wiser than that.
I bet you could wrestle grizzly bears in Texas, though. Like, if someone wanted to train.
Oh, yeah. You could probably shoot them, too. Probably do whatever you want.
Yeah, we could do a brown bear wrestling training camp.
As long as it's an exotic, that's the whole thing about Texas. Like, if it's an exotic animal, meaning it's not indigenous.
It's not native.
You can kind of do whatever the fuck you want to it.
It is crazy.
Texas is a fascinating place. It's one of the weird states that almost all the land is private. That's a rare thing. Like, there's a public land system in this country with, you know, the Bureau of Land Management and all the different national parks. There's, like, none of that in Texas. You know, Texas is mostly just private ranches. That's weird, right?
It's very weird. Yeah, it's very weird. There's been roads I've been down where you're just driving, and for miles and miles and miles, it's nothing but high fence. It's like people's private ranches just, like, gated in.
Yeah.
You know.
It's strange because they have these ranches that they seem like wilderness because the ranch will be like 10,000 acres, right? But if it's 10,000 acres, it's fenced in. And part of you goes, well, hey, man, the whole country's fenced in. You get to the ocean, you can't go any further. That shit's kind of like a fence.
I haven't heard that excuse, but there you go.
That's how I look at it.
Yeah.
You go far enough north, you hit the ice.
Yep.
You hit the glaciers.
Yeah.
Where are you going?
Yeah.
But... there's something about that kind of experience. Like, that's one of the weirder things about Texas is that they have these enormous fenced-in properties where they have all these African animals running around.
Yeah.
Like Nilgai and elands and...
You name it.
Yeah. And they're
zebras,
they have more of those animals running around in Texas than they do in the wild of their countries. Like oryx.
Yeah.
Like oryx, they're threatened in other parts of the world, right?
They've got a ton of them down there.
Texas, they got a fuckload.
And black bucks.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have lots of stuff. Axis the same way.
But so how do you feel about that? Like if the place is like, this is like a philosophical argument, right? If it's 10,000 acres and it's fenced in, that's far greater than their natural range, right?
Yeah.
They normally wouldn't wander any further than that.
It's an ongoing debate. I mean, it is.
Squirrely, right?
Yeah, it's squirrely. Yeah, there's because even with, like, animals that they, you know, where they want to score and then put into, like, record books, you know, to keep track of scores. So, you know, there's certain scoring clubs that don't recognize anything with a high fence. But then at the same time, there's, like, members within those organizations that are like, well, wait a minute. You know, if a ranch is 15,000 acres, that's, you know, they kind of have this same argument, and they said, well, is that? And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, if there is. And as a hunter, it's one of the things that there's kind of a continual debate. Some hunters absolutely refuse to hunt anything that has any sort of containment. Other people have their kind of their, you know, they have their own threshold of, well, if it's 5,000 or more, then I'm kind of okay with it. Mm. It's hard. I mean, it's no different than, you know, some people in the hunting community, some people only want to hunt animals that are on public land. And then some people, you know, like to hunt areas where it's, you know, it's managed properties, it's privately owned properties that have really good management, and you know that, you know, you're shooting, you know, a certain age limit, you're kind of culling out, you know, the older animals maybe that aren't breeding anymore. So yeah, there's continual differences of what people feel like, you know, they want to accept. Some people want to be able to, some people just like hunting, like Nugent. He just loves hunting his ranch, right? I mean, he hunts that thing, and
I think, but he also has, he has a problem moving around well. He doesn't, I mean, he can't really go elk hunting, like where he goes hiking into the mountains 8-10 hours a day.
He legitimately loves hunting Texas ranches.
Yeah.
Like he legitimately
hunts. But
he
sits
it.
At tree stands. I mean, I think he's limited to that. Like he has two bad knees, like really bad. Like he's got artificial knees. He's had some serious surgeries.
We've got friends that love to hunt like exotic ranches.
Yeah. Well, but I could see the argument both ways.
Yeah.
Like look, if you're a meat eater and you want to get meat from a free range cattle ranch, you know, you only want grass fed, grass finished beef. Yep. that's free range, that roams around. Like there's a lot of people that feel that way.
Yep.
Well, why are you hunting? Are you hunting because you want meat? Are you hunting because you want to kill your own meat? Are you hunting because you want to eat wild game? Are you hunting because it's fun? Or are you hunting for all the reasons, all the above? And if it's an all the above, some people feel like the only kind of hunting they want to do is backpacking, public land,
yep,
go into the wilderness, and they don't want to have anything to do with raising those animals, helping those animals. They want those animals to be straight up wild,
yep,
you know, and they feel like that is the most ethical way. There's a lot of weird debates about public land, too. Here's one that really gets me. There's a lot of people that are really into public land, and the public land is super important to them. They only want to hunt public land, but they have secret spots on public land, and they don't want anybody to know about them. And if you tell someone about their spot on public land, they'll get mad at you. Like, if you take someone to a spot, I've heard Ranella talk about this on his show. Like, he's a big public land guy.
Yep.
But he'll talk on his show about what a betrayal it is if you tell a person about a spot and they tell someone else about that spot.
Yep.
Or they go to that spot without you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Is this public land or is it not? And if it's not, if it is public land, if you're telling someone about a spot, you're telling me that this public land spot, you don't want them going to without you?
Not unless they find it on their own.
That is fucking ridiculous, right? That's ridiculous. It's like you
it's
have
a
private
line.
Spot.
Yeah,
have a private spot on public land. So you're a public land guy until it infringes on your own privacy. Like,
yep,
you figured out a way to have a private spot on public land. And if you share this private spot with someone else, they're not allowed to go there without you. Fuck you. That's crazy.
Dude, the number one rule in fishing, too.
Someone it's either takes private you, or it's not.
Yeah, but if someone takes you to a sweet little spot where they just rip lips constantly on a lake, and then next thing you know, they go out there on a weekend and you're sitting there in your boat with a bunch of buddies.
That's stupid. Is
they're
this a
get
public
mad.
Lake
they're
or not?
They're going to be like, bro, I took you to my spot.
Well, they're assholes. That's stupid.
I don't think so.
You think they should not go there?
I think there's...
Do you think they own that spot? It's
no,
a fucking giant lake.
No, they
lake.
Don't own it.
Okay.
They don't own it.
Let's talk about like Lake Superior.
Okay.
We've got a giant ass lake.
Yep.
And someone has a spot where all the lake trout live.
A little reef, yeah.
Yeah.
Where everything's chilling
and
out.
You tell me about that spot. And then you go back there 6 months later and I'm at that spot. You're going to be mad at me?
No, probably not.
Not me, but what if it's a guy that you don't know as well?
If I went back and you had a whole bunch of guys there, it'd be like, dude, should have saved this spot for us.
That's ridiculous. It's a fucking public lake.
I'm not taking you in any of my spots.
Better not. See, this is the thing. These people that say they want everything to be public, that's not public. It's not public if you don't want other people going back there.
I see the argument, though, because he put in the work to find a good place that took work within public land.
Then you better not tell people about it or they're going to go back.
Yeah, that's where that you go wrong. Yeah, if you find it, you got to just keep it quiet.
That's so corny. That's so ridiculous. Like, you want that spot to yourself. You want that spot to be private.
In a way, yeah, you do.
Yeah, you're making a private area. Mm-hmm. In public land. That's what you're doing.
Yep.
I think that's preposterous.
Well, could you imagine if you, say you were going elk hunting, you left camp an hour and a half before daylight, and you pack all the way out there, and there's someone sitting on your glassing rock in that basin.
It's not yours.
But you would still say, someone I should have never first. Told this guy that
it's
it was here.
It's public land.
All right.
Someone got there first.
No one's ever going to tell you about their spot.
This is a spot that's been the same way for hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah, it's
been
that way. It has. But someone found it, put in the work to find it.
This is some small-minded thinking, man.
Yep.
This is some small-minded thinking.
I know. Sorry.
But this is a common way of thinking.
I'd say there's people that don't think that way, but there's certainly people that are. I would have to side with Rennell on that.
Really?
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. So if someone takes you to a place and it's this really good mule deer spot and you hike in 7 miles and it's this beautiful basin and you go there and there's just always deer there. You don't go there without that person's permission?
I would say, are you going to be there? And if he said no, and I'd say, can I go? I wouldn't take
what?
Anyone. That would be code. That'd be code,
can
man.
Can I go to national forest land?
Yep.
Can I go to public land? Can I go to this spot that you don't fucking own even a little bit?
Out of respect for that guy that found it.
Found it?
Yeah.
He just walked. He walked on the dirt.
It.
Found what? A tree? This is my tree.
Yeah.
This is crazy. This is my rock that I stand on. This top of the cliff is my cliff. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you can take it to a point, but
it's crazy.
I still think it's code.
It's a weird code.
The other argument, though, too, is just from a hunting situation.
Jamie, as a person who doesn't hunt at all, does
Jamie,
this seem ridiculous?
I mean, I've heard it, so I understand. Like, it's not a new concept to me, but I'm trying to compare it to something else. Like, if it was like a basketball hoop I found somewhere, and I'm like, I don't tell somebody to go to that playground because it's my hoop, and I show up and people are there playing.
A public
just
playground.
Find another hoop to play on.
Well,
or you don't play basketball that day.
It seems...
Kind of
it seems ridiculous.
It's silly, but I'm just trying to think,
that you, like, you have a, especially in today's day and age, because today people use, like, Onyx maps and they use Google Earth, and you could find these beautiful spots and you just go out to them. Like, if you find a beautiful spot on Google Earth and you go out to it and you go, hey, man, this is a spot I found. Don't go there. This is my spot. This is my spot on public land. Seems ridiculous.
Yeah. It does. It does. But I think there's a legitimate code to it.
It seems ridiculous, but it seems understandable that someone would be upset if they're looking forward to going to a place and they told you about it a year ago and they go to that place, they hike in, takes them 9 miles, and then you're there.
Yeah.
Tough shit. Go another 9. Should have got there earlier, you procrastinating motherfucker.
I'm taking you with me when we're going to someone's spot.
No one owns any spots. See, that's what's so weird about it to me. It's
there definitely is a line. I mean, I see your argument 100%, and I know it. You know, at some point it could definitely get childish or out of hand. I mean, obviously there's a ton of stuff, but out of courtesy, yeah. I mean, if anytime you showed me something cool, if you're like, hey, I got this cool thing, this is what I do, you know. It's kind of private, take my family there, whatever. I'd be like, yeah, I respect that.
But it's not private. That's what's weird.
Yeah.
What's weird
right.
is the whole
well, water's
thing
not
about
either.
Public land.
But fishermen would be the same, right?
But it's
captains,
it's still crazy.
Boat captains.
The
it
whole
is.
Thing about public land is that it's supposed to be everyone's. So if you find a really good area in public land that's supposed to be available for everyone.
Yep.
But that's not what everybody wants. What everybody wants, that's one of the things about people not wanting new people to get into hunting. Like, I've heard this argument before. Like, you shouldn't be telling people to get into hunting because it's already tough enough out there on public land. There's already so many people hunting on public land. If more people get into hunting, there's going to be more pressure. Like, what?
Yeah, that's not me. I'm definitely looking to get more people in for sure.
Right, because you're thinking they don't know about your spots.
I'll find a new spot.
That's a good attitude.
One of the questions, or I guess arguments too, is, you know, I don't understand it when people, they don't have any tolerance for like hunting private land, so to speak, or they don't have tolerance for, you know, I don't mind people that hunt like exotic ranches or hunt high fence. That's just not, that's like not what I personally like. But I also understand that people do. But I also don't like it when people are like super negative to that, but yet they'll have like a bull in a pen, or they'll have chickens in a cage, mm-hmm. or they'll have a goat and they're like raising
a
goat to slaughter. I don't know, is it?
Yeah, it is, because it shows
it's just a different scale.
No, but it's not, because it shows that there's a different thing in the pursuit of a wild animal. There's a different thing to that. Like here's the thing. Say if there's a ranch, and the ranch is 5,000 acres, which is big, but not the biggest.
Yeah.
And on that 5,000-acre ranch, someone shoots a giant buck, like a huge 240-inch mule deer, like epic deer. And people are like, wow. But it's a private ranch, and you kind of know that there wasn't a lot of pressure there, so they probably knew where this deer was, and people that worked in this ranch told people about this deer, and they kind of kept their eye on it, and they knew where to go to find him.
Yep.
Versus you getting in your truck, driving 4 hours outside of Reno in Nevada, getting out into the mountains by yourself,
yep.
you know, like setting up camp by yourself, spending 3 or 4 days just scouting. Just
finding your spot.
Finding
your spot.
Animals out there, finding your spot. But it's more difficult is the point. So like if someone accomplishes that, you look at it differently
yeah.
than someone who shot something in a high ranch in Texas. It's yep. just a different thing.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is like hunters versus non-hunters, people that are non-hunting that really look down on like what we're talking about as hunters, but yet they'll raise a goat.
Right.
To slaughter.
But they're not pretending that it's some sort of pursuit, man versus animal. See, the thing about the hunting thing yeah. is you're looking at it like it's a difficult pursuit. Like
yeah.
you're out there trying to outwit this animal.
For me, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I like about it.
But if you're in a 400-acre fenced-in property with a bunch of exotics running around, you're sitting in a tree stand, there's a pile of corn down there, and you're waiting for an animal to walk over to that corn and you whack it.
Yep.
That is very different than, say, what you did this year in Alberta when you
yeah.
were telling me that you were hiking hundreds of – I mean, how many days did you guys go?
I think we went 9, did 100 miles.
Yeah, so you hiked 100 miles in the wilderness for 9 days.
No elk and never got one.
And never got one.
Never got one.
Yeah.
Yep.
That is very different.
Yep.
Right? So
oh, yeah.
that's real hunting.
Yeah.
In comparison to someone who's sitting over a pile of corn at a fenced-in ranch.
Yeah.
See, that's why I think people have a problem with it.
Yeah.
That anybody would compare what you did to that. And then there's, like, the intermediary, which is, like, a really nice ranch that's not a high fence, but it's a private ranch, like the place we went to in Utah.
Yeah.
That is, it's private. Not everybody can go there, but those are just wild animals roaming around.
And opportunity's high.
Yes, you know. More opportunity, but nothing's fenced in, nothing's keeping the animals there. And those animals have been there for thousands of years.
Yeah.
That's just what they do.
Mm-hmm.
You just have the opportunity to hunt a wild animal on a piece of property where there's not going to be a lot of people there.
Yep. Yeah, it's my preference. I really like the balance of having really tough hunts, especially because I knew my Utah hunt wouldn't quite be the same. That was kind of a very different experience for me. I haven't ever like had an opportunity like that, so that was, you know, quite a quite a difference for me. Whereas between the other states that I hunted, I think I did, I think I was right at just over 200 miles before we got our first bull, you know, between there and then hunting some private land, but also some public land in Montana before finally getting, you know, that first elk.
Can you talk about what happened with Montana with the bear?
Yeah. I mean, I can talk about it. They actually texted me back and ruled back that it was not a grizzly.
What?
Yeah, they say it's a colored black bear.
Do you think that's true?
Yeah, it's possible. I was going to pull up the pictures.
It's an enormous black bear.
Yeah, yeah.
Thought it was a grizzly.
Yep. We shot our mutual friend, Andy Stumpf, shot a bull on 9/11. Which was pretty cool for him to have an experience like that. And it took us I forget how far out we were, just several miles from camp, and it took us two trips to pack this bull out. And the first pack out that we did, I think we finally got back to camp, I don't know, somewhere around midnight or something. So the next morning we went back at first light. It took us a while to pack back in there, and when we got there, half of the carcass, I had already pulled everything apart. We had everything in game bags. Everything was strung up in trees. But the actual cavity was half buried. And as we were approaching, I seen something kind of running off. And by the coloration on the hide, I really thought for sure it was a grizz, because I've seen lots of them. And we got up there, and sure enough, it was buried. So we kind of took a lot of precaution as we were trying to.
And just explain to people what that means.
So a grizzly, they will bury something that they find, and I think they do it for a couple reasons. One of the reasons is they don't want like prey birds like crows and stuff to be able to see it, because they'll start talking and then other predators in the area listen for those birds, and then, you know, it's kind of a magnet, starts to draw. So they like to conceal it. So they'll literally kind of pivot on a circle around that kill and actually claw the ground and bury them. And it's pretty, like, I've seen where grizzlies bury a full moose, and it is ridiculous the type of dirt they can move. I'm talking, it looks like a skid loader came in there and buried these things. And they can do that kind of work fairly quick. But they'll pile up everything around it. And then they kind of normally will create one small little hole at the end of that mound where they'll kind of crawl in there, and they literally like eat from one side to the other side, you know. And it's normally the back end first. So yeah, I felt like we had just got there when this bear had just discovered the carcass and had just started the burial process, because, you know, he hadn't pulled anything out of the trees. He had only started to cover the carcass, which normally they'll cover that seal first, then they'll clean up the scraps around, and then they go to their pile and kind of consume that last. But I was certain that we had seen one. We ended up seeing a wildlife biologist later on, and I told him, you know, I thought I saw a grizz, and he told me, he said, well, it's pretty important if you did, because there hasn't been one naturally on this hill in, I think he said, 100 years. So he's like, you know, would you be willing to go back in there to put a camera up? Which is not smart. If it was a grizzly, obviously they're going to be, depending on their demeanor, they could be very protective of that. We did end up going back in there just to put the camera up. And then after the camera was there a few weeks, he sent a picture and said, you were close to being right. It's just a perfectly colored, black bear that looks like it would be a grizzly.
But how does he know for sure?
You can tell by, they don't have,
you thought it was a grizzly when you saw the photo.
Yeah, they don't have a very, I thought it was a younger one, but they don't have a very distinct hump on their back. And then the claw marks. See, he went in, you can tell a lot by the claws. So when you go in and you look at the tracks, that's also a really easy way. Because like that bear that was wrestling Khabib, you could see the claws. Like grizzlies have very, very distinct claws. So that was just looking here. So I can't really pull up the pick for everybody.
You can send it to Jamie. Let me check it out. Yeah, I can see that. That's look. Yeah,
and
that does
and,
actually kind of look like a brown bear now that I look at and it, then, or a black bear rather.
Yeah, and then running the head is going to be narrower. Yeah. And it took several pictures. Some of the pictures it looked more like a grizz just because of the coloration. Some of the pictures it didn't. So, you know, and keep in mind, you know, mountain grizzlies will look a little bit different than like a coastal bear or, you know, an inland grizzly. But either way, it was a bear that came in and, you know, covered the whole carcass and went to eat it.
Now, so. When you were in Alberta, you went back to that place that you were talking about on the first podcast we ever did, where you had that encounter where you shot that elk that was just outside of that wolf den.
Yeah.
And the wolves tried to claim the elk. Yeah. You guys had to shoot your way out of there.
Yeah.
That is a fucking crazy story. What was it like to be back there again?
It was, what was strange about it is while we were there, I actually found that they were back in that area. There was some fresh tracks, and then we heard one howl like during that thing. So it was almost like it was a little bit weird because.
Did you guys bring extra bullets this time?
We only had my bow this time. I'm sending you this, Jamie.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, the thing that's always kind of creeped me out a little bit was just. It was, I felt like I had like a kind of a personal connection with that alpha male because the way, you know, he came in at the very end because he wanted to know what the heck had taken out three of his pack. He wanted, like, it's almost like he's like, I know we're getting out of here, but I want to see this for myself because, you know, they were close enough, but I don't think they could totally see us. Yeah,
there's
there it
a
is.
Bear.
So as that was going away,
It looked like a grizzly. Yeah, it does look like a brown bear, or a black bear, though, in the nose.
Yep. See how the face is more narrow? So, yeah.
And then the claws, too.
Yep. Yeah, which, like, on the right foot, the claw looks more like a black bear. On the left foot, there was some grass there that made it a little bit strange. But when that alpha male came in to kind of, you know, I think he just wanted to know, okay, what's caused all this stuff. So, you know, I looked him in the face and just pretty much said, I'm going to shoot you in the face. I always, every time I go back in that area, I'm like, you know, if this old sucker is walking around, he knows my smell. He's probably going to be like, there's
that. Do you think
that.
He remembers you?
Yeah. I personally, they are smart. I could picture him remembering it and saying, oh, okay.
I owe this dude.
I'm going to make him into a hairy turd on the side of. Yeah. I sent you that that big wolf shit that had porcupine quills all
over
it.
Yeah, I put that on Instagram.
It's funny how many people are like, that is not porcupine quills. It's like, listen, people, I'm in the outdoors 200 days, probably a year, and if there's porcupine quills coming out of a pile of shit, I'm pretty sure I know what it is.
It's hard to tell from a photo.
Yeah.
But if you see, it's on my Instagram,
oh,
Jamie.
Great. Here we go.
It's a pile of shit with porcupine quills in it. Can you imagine how goddamn hungry you have to be eating porcupine quills and swallow
them? I think
a
wolf's that tough. He doesn't care. It's like a bear. Look at how many bears will just go head first into a pile of ant, like a fire ant bed or a wasp nest.
Yeah.
Like yellow jackets.
There it is. Make that a little bigger, please.
Down in the bottom, you can see some nice quills.
Yeah. Yeah, some people go, that's hair.
Yeah, there is porcupine hair in there, correct.
But those are also quills.
there's a couple of blood drops up there. Oof. Yeah, that needs some prep H.
Howie.
Yeah, they're beasts. They're beasts. That is, you know, I think their intelligence level is super high. I think a lot of, you know, the more you're in the outdoors and you experience things, demeanors and their ability to survive. You know, you look at an old grizzly that's been in those woods for 20 years. Think of the experience level that thing has surviving every single day. Mm. I mean, every day just. maybe making a slight mistake, slipping up a little bit, almost getting jacked by another grizzly, and then you're like, oh, yep, I know not to do this, I know not to do that. I mean, their intelligence level and their ability to function is extremely high, and wolves are, I mean, arguably wolves probably get shot less than probably any of the other animals. I mean, they are incredibly smart. So yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. You know, it was and they were very, after that, they were very intent in that area for people to, they put up some pretty big bounties on the wolves, and they really went after them and knocked those herds down quite a bit, because there was very few mule deer, like very few mule deer. You'd hardly see a doe and a fawn. They had to cut the number of tags way down. Elk, as soon as wolves like howl at night, if a pack moves into an area and they howl, like calling elk is just non-existent. They just, everything's just like, don't say nothing, because, you know, they're here. So yeah, I think them thinning them down was very relevant. And since then, which was quite a while ago, the numbers of like elk and moose, this past year I saw way more moose than I've seen. I think they're really hard on moose fawns. And yeah, I mean, moose, muleys, whitetails. I saw way more animals this year than in the past up there. And I think it's just because that moose number, or the wolf number, was just much lower. But there was, like I said, there was still sign that there was some in the area, just nothing like several years ago when I was there. It was, even I would say, as much as I appreciate balance in nature, it was excessive. And it's getting that way now, like even in Wisconsin. I remember I was talking to a friend of mine up in an area. I used to live up by, kind of in the La Crosse area. I actually lived a little northeast of La Crosse by a small town called Cataract. And there was a few times where there were some wolf spottings. There's a big military base here called Fort McCoy. And I lived up on the northern side of the base, what was called the impact area. They kind of shot test rounds over and they kind of, I don't know, went off there or whatever. But there was an incredible number of like deer and things that were in there. So, you know, kind of the rumor was that they had introduced wolves into their timber wolves to kind of thin down some of those numbers. Well, now it's to the point where the amount of people I know in Wisconsin that see wolves is just rapidly increasing. And obviously when that happens, you know, they eat stuff. I mean, wolves don't mess around. They take stuff down. And sometimes it's just strange. You don't understand the balance of why there's an introduction to something that, you know, has the possibility to just take over. You know, it's strange.
Well, it is, but it's also, there needs to be some sort of balance. You don't want the animals overpopulating, and you do want some sort of a balance between predator and prey. But the real problem becomes when people don't want to manage the predators.
Right.
They only want, they want nature to sort itself out.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work that way, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, people need to understand, like, if you do like deer and you like moose and you like all these other animals, you can't have too many wolves. You
prey
can't
animals.
Have too many. Yeah. You can't have too many grizzlies, because if you do, you're going to have very few of those other animals. You're not going to see them. They're going to get wiped out. And in some places, like, they're almost at the point of extinction. Like, what is that caribou herd that's in North America?
Caribou herd. Yeah, I'm not that familiar with it, because I've never really been a caribou person, you know, from a hunting aspect.
But they're an animal that's like severely targeted by wolves.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could see it. Anything with a very predictable migration is going to be very prone to, you know, to any type of prey creature. You look at any of the migrations of like wildebeest and stuff like that in Africa, where they're having to migrate. It's like those crocs are just like, oh yeah, here we go.
We know where that river crossing is.
We know where the neck down is. It's the same thing. It's
caribou, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know this, but many people don't. The females actually have antlers, and the reason why they have antlers is to fend off wolves.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, female caribou have antlers.
Yeah,
they're one of the only deer species where the females have antlers.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Make sure that's true.
I don't think. Well, I mean, I guess.
Pretty sure it is.
I guess if it's for wolves, but
they all have antlers, right? all caribou have antlers.
Well, you're making me question it. I didn't think so, but
I think they do.
How good was that elk from
that you
Utah?
Cooked in camp? Oh, yeah. Fantastic! Is that true? I'm right. Ooh, yeah.
You're usually right.
People would disagree. I'd say 8 out of 10 times. There's a few times where I say things though, and I go, "What the fuck are you saying? You know what you're saying?" I don't
know.
Question.
Yeah, you question it
always,
and you laugh about it.
Yeah. No, I'm no expert. I'm an expert in very, very few things. But
I think you have very your intelligence level is high.
It just says that males are tend to be a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
And their antlers are a little bit bigger, but yeah, they both have them.
Yeah, see if it's true that the females have it to fend off wolves. I think that's theoretical, actually.
Yeah, it
I don't think
the
there's any way
that's
they know.
The part that's the part where I was like, wow.
I'm pretty sure I saw that in a documentary, that the females have it to fend off wolves. That was speculation.
360 video of them.
What a cool animal, man. They're so cool looking.
They are
cool. I've never hunted them. I would like to. They're supposed to be delicious, and there's a shitload of them. Like, that's the crazy thing about Alaska, the areas of Alaska. Like, they'll have hundreds and hundreds of them in these streams, you know.
More than that, depending on the migration. Yeah.
Sure. But not streams, you know, whatever, a path full of them. There's one with no antlers. Must have lost them. Do they lose their antlers? Like,
all of them have them. It says there are exceptions. Like, there's only one.
Look at this one. This dude got jacked. But you'll see elk like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We see that.
Yours had a broken tine, didn't it?
A little one, yeah. Not a big broken one, but we saw one that I almost shot that only had one antler.
Yeah, you like that. When you were with me and you shot that one whitetail, I'm like, he's broken on one side. You're like, I want a gangster.
Dudes, they're going down. It doesn't bother me. The antlers to me are secondary. Number one, I want the meat, and I want a mature animal. But two, it doesn't bother me if their things snapped off. It means they're just going to war.
Yeah.
You know?
I was really pumped for that camp specifically because I had several good friends there, and I really – you know, I'm just geeked out right now about cooking. You know,
me
just,
too.
Just, I mean, cooking stuff, doing stuff different.
That neck that you made?
Exactly.
Oh, my God. I have to figure out. You got to give me that recipe, and I got to figure out how to do that. That was sensational, man. That was so good. That roast.
Yeah, we had 51 people. Well, there's a lot of camera people there. There was guides. There was, I think, people that maybe worked there. But yeah, I made a massive. I took the one half of the elk neck and did a forward sear. So, you know, we've talked about reverse sear that our buddy Chad Ward taught us. But this was I call it a forward sear. Maybe I'm wrong, but
it's just a sear.
Yeah. So I sear at the beginning in a big cast iron pot. We had a massive cast iron pot, barely didn't even fit in the Traeger. And so we seared that whole neck and then seasoned it really well. I seasoned it with like a Traeger Prime rib rub and then a coffee rub. And then I put some of the Black Rifle Knocked and Loaded coffee in there and then put in, I think about, it was, the pot was so massive, but I put in about 6 cups of bone broth and then covered it with a cast iron lid. Wrapped it all up in foil and then cooked it at 225, I think for about 18 hours because of how big it was. And then we knew it was about ready to be done. So we grilled some peppers and I think, is that all we put in there? Grilled a bunch of peppers and stuff?
Yeah, it was like bell peppers.
Yep, bell peppers. And normally I do some jalapenos too. We didn't have any. And then,
just put onions in there too? I feel like there's maybe some carrots or something in there too.
Well, there was onions. We did grill some onions kind of until they were caramelized. But then opened that up and more or less just took 2 forks and it just fell apart.
Yeah.
I mean, just fell apart and kind of did it all. It looked like a pulled pork butt is what it looked like. And then we went ahead and put in all the grilled peppers and stuff in there, put a little bit of sauce in there, some Texas spicy and a little bit of sriracha. I covered it back up and just let it – we actually took it out and set it in the Yeti and then let it just kind of sit in that Yeti for about – well, we went out on the evening hunt and then we came back. and then we ate it for dinner. So it just sat in that Yeti and just kind of maintained temperature and just let all the juices and everything redistribute back through that shredded meat after we shredded it. And then people just went crazy. The amount of people that were coming up to me saying, "What was that?" And I'm like, "Neck." And they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that a giant bull with this neck that practically dulled knives trying to cut through was just that awesome. But it really is. Like, low and slow is the name of the game on some of that stuff. And
well, those Traeger grills, any sort of pellet grill, is such a great way to cook something like that too, because you can maintain the exact temperature for long periods of time. And the thing about, if you've never used a pellet grill, folks, they use these pellets that are made out of wood. So like this table, if you're going to make this table, they would use the saw to make the table, and they would take the actual sawdust and compress it. And the natural sugars in the wood make this compressed pellet. So they don't add any chemicals or anything. It's just wood.
Right.
And then they have this element that heats it up, and then they have this little worm drive that feeds pellets down into the heated up area. So the heated up area turns into – yeah, look at that. Bam. The heated up area turns into fire, and you got this little fire going on in this hopper, where this hopper feeds down into this cup, rather. So the fire's in the cup, and it keeps dropping pellets in there, so it's a natural fire. It's just fire and wood, and it gives this great flavor to the food that you're cooking, whatever, we're cooking vegetables or anything you're cooking, meat. And and those things maintain temperature so well, so you could keep it on 190 degrees and just keep it at 190 for a fucking day. Yeah. And they're so efficient that you never have to add pellets. Like, you could do the entire 16, 18 hours worth of cooking just on one hopper full of pellets.
Oh, easy. Yeah.
Easy.
I think they said one bag of pellets is equivalent to like a full propane thing.
Yeah, so this is what we cooked in camp. John made that is what's called the backstrap, which is would be a
essentially a tomahawk cut.
Yeah.
That's a full section of tomahawk steaks. Those are all elk. There's the pot in the background.
So it's basically the rib, and where the rib goes up to the top of the back, and the back, that meat that goes along the top of the spine is what most people like best out of elk.
Yeah, I got to find that picture of the two.
So we cooked it like that with the bones attached just for novelty.
Yeah.
But it was super delicious.
Yeah, people like having that handle to chow down on.
It was super delicious. And the fact that we were doing it in camp from an elk that you had shot literally the day before.
Yeah.
So it was as fresh as it gets.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you're doing it in the mountains, the view out there, and just it's incredible.
Yeah, it was awesome. I was happy to tag out early just because of the fact I was, I had a lot of good friends there, and we were able to grill out and chill out, and I think we probably ate about a third of that thing over the
we ate a ton of it. Well, when you were in Alberta, you shot a deer early in your hunt, didn't you guys eat almost the entire deer?
Yeah,
the time
we did.
You were there?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did.
That's a big ass deer too.
Yeah, we ate a ton of Andy's elk too. When Andy shot his bull on 9/11, we still had I think 5 days left of hunting, so we ate elk 3 meals a day. One of the things I always do is I'll always take a Traeger with me, honestly, it sounds weird, but it's an investment to, even if it's one of the portable ones, just to get one there.
Well, that new one that they have is awesome.
That's Ranger.
The really small one?
Yep.
That thing is perfect. That's
yeah,
perfect size. And it's not heavy either.
No.
That
no.
thing's a perfect size for camping.
Yeah, it's I'm trying to think. I don't know what the weight is, but yeah, it's perfect for camping. And you can just plug it in. Like, I have a Ram truck, and you can actually just plug in right inside. I normally just have an extension cord, run it through the rear window, and just plug and go. I mean, I took one with me and Sharon went down to Oklahoma hunting, and actually
that thing right there.
Yep.
Yeah. How much does that thing weigh? Does it say?
I don't know. It's not super light because I mean they are heavy. They are heavy duty. 41 pounds. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
for on the go. It's awesome. And the new Ranger one's actually a little better than that one. It's got a digital. scale for the thermostat.
Is the new one for sale?
Yeah.
Or is what's this one?
This one sold out.
Yeah, that one sold out. There was the new one's called the Ranger. But yeah, they're dynamite. You can just plug them in. You don't. Well, we were talking. Yeah, there it is, right there, $399.
Yeah, that's the thing.
You know, if you lived in the city, like I've got a, I bring him up a lot just because I think what he does is cool. But I've got a buddy that lives in New York, and I found him on Instagram working out in Central Park all the time. And one time I was in, I was close to Central Park in the morning, and I knew he always worked out early, so I text him at like 5 a.m. I said, "Hey, dude." I said, "Are you up?" And he texted back and said, "Yeah, his name is Joseph." And I said, "I want to do one of these Central Park workouts with you." And he just carries some supplies in a big backpack, and he rucks in, and then he literally just like has certain rocks and stuff, and he has
If he got there and you were on his rock, would he get mad?
No, he would be happy. See, we've got to learn a lesson here by Joseph. Yeah, exactly. So I did a workout with him, but, you know, he was telling me, he's like, you know, if you ever get any of that elk meat or anything, I'd love, you know, I'd love to try it. And he's big into, I think, keto. But he was telling me how much he pays for store-bought meat in New York. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, that is astronomical. And he's like, and I don't really know where it comes from. You know, and for someone that's that in tune with his body, he was, you know, kind of disappointed that that's what his options were. But then I started thinking, I'm like, well, do you have the ability for like a grill? You know, living in Iowa or living where, you know, you are, we've got some big grills. We have the space for it. But, you know, some people, I think back to myself when I was in my 20s living in an apartment, you know, I wouldn't have had the space for that. That right there is a great option.
Yeah.
You know, it's literally not much bigger than a couple briefcases.
Put it on your patio.
Put it on your patio. If you're cooking for two, it would be perfect. And
yeah, you could easily cook for two on that thing. You can cook for more than two on that thing.
And the cleanup is the most important thing with any pellet grill, if anyone's ever going to get one. The two things I can tell you are most important is one, just recognize that, you know, it runs off a wooden pellet. So treat the pellets like you would campfire wood. You know, if you leave campfire wood out where it's getting rain on all the time, you know, it's going to be a pain to start it or it's not going to burn that great. So if you keep those dry, I always put my pellets after I pour the bag in, whatever's left, I actually put in one of my Yeti buckets and put that, you know, that kind of, it's, I don't know, it's like a sealable lid that I push down.
Traeger makes buckets. They make buckets specifically for them. They sent me a couple of them.
The buckets are good, but keeping your pellet, you know, if you're in a high humidity place like Florida, don't keep your pellets outside. You know, if they're in the grill and you're using the grill, that's one thing, but don't keep the bags of them out there all the time. And then as you use it, there's the little, it's called I think they call it a burning pot. Essentially, your pellets are burning in a small pot. Think of that just the same as you would a campfire pit. As you're burning wood all the time, there's going to be ash left. And if that pot fills up with ash, there's not going to be the ability for as much pellets to go in there, so it's not going to burn as hot. So, you know, if you get to the point where you're not able to get to your higher temperatures, it's probably because you have
too much ash.
You've got too much ash in your pot. So, yeah, clean it out, and then it'll pretty much from there be as easy as flipping it to on and turning it to the temperature that you want, and it's done.
Yeah, I was telling you that I tried cooking on a regular grill, a propane grill, the other day, and it just sucked. It was flaring up. There's, you know, fire and smoke because the fat was dripping down into the fire. It's like, it's a shitty way of cooking. They do have a really cool grill, though, that cooks from above. I've seen one of those. It's pretty badass. Like, you can raise or lower the heat and bring it closer to the meat or lift it above, and so you don't get any flare-ups. It just cooks from above.
Well, it's definitely a better way to do it if you're using propane. Because I remember once I bought some ribeyes, and this was back when I didn't have the money to buy good steaks, but I had some people over and I thought, I'm going to buy some good steaks. Went out and, you know, spent quite a bit getting some good ribeyes and everything. And because there's so much marbling, I remember I came inside, I had those on the grill, I didn't even have them that high for temperature. I came inside and I, you know, started working on vegetables or pouring drinks for people. And all of a sudden I look out and there's just smoke rolling out of my Weber. And I go out there and lift it up and my ribeyes, all that marbling, just, it was just a big burning mess. It looked like I took a flamethrower to one half of my ribeyes. I was so bummed out.
Yeah, it's hard doing it right.
Yeah.
There's an art to cooking.
There is.
It's one of the things that I'm really learning from getting into hunting and getting into cooking my own food is learning how to do it correctly. And it's fun. There's a real art to it, you know, like that neck roast that you made.
Yep.
Or like some of the more interesting things. Do you ever do shanks?
Yeah. Yeah. I did two last week.
Yeah.
I shot that whitetail in South Dakota. And I took both of the front quarters and then did slow cooks with those, and they're awesome. You know, the key for any of that stuff that normally has a lot of tendons and stuff, that's a tougher section of the meat, a lot of people try to cook them too fast, and you don't break down that cartilage. You know, you need that cartilage to really cook slow to the point where it, like, gels, and it breaks down, and it almost turns into marbling, and then it'll turn into flavoring, which is kind of what happened with that, with the neck. You know, once it cooks slow enough, even all those harder tendons that are in there, they just slowly start decomposing. They become like more of a marbling that's mixed in, and it's really, really good. I mean, it's awesome. And I'm a big advocate on the simpler you keep things cooking wise, for me, the better the flavors are that I get. I'm a very simple cook. And when people ask me to do, you know, people see pictures that I post cooking and they're like, well, you know, you need to do a cookbook. No, I'm not. My cookbook would be boring because it would be, you know, olive oil, probably, you know, I would have coffee for rub. I'd have like a prime rib rub, you know, probably a decent like rock salt. But other than that, like grass-fed butters, olive oils, or a couple basic rubs, that's all I use, period. And a bone broth if I do like a, if I cook something slow to break down. But I just literally stay with those staple things. And from there, you know, I'll cook according to the directions. One of the things I learned to do was rest my meat. So I won't take meat off and just cut right into it.
And you rest it in a cooler.
Yeah, I rest it in a Yeti all the time. All the time.
And you cover it with aluminum foil. And it
or
actually,
butcher paper, either
when
one.
You do it, like, do you get it to a certain temperature? Like, say if you want your meat to hit an internal temperature of like 130, do you get it to like 120 and then put it in the cooler and then let it rise to like 130 while it's in there? Because it keeps cooking, right?
Yeah, it's gonna rise some. Mm. Yeah, it will rise some.
You got to plan that out before you rest it, too, if you're going to do it in a cooler, right?
Yeah. Normally, it depends how long you're going to rest it. Normally, I plan on about 6 degrees it'll go up. But you can, as you're resting it in the cooler, you can still check it. You know, you can let it sit for 10 or 15 minutes and then check it. Normally, for me, 5 degrees is a really good number. Like, if I'll stop 5 degrees less than where I want to eat it. Because when I put it in there and wrap it up, most vegetables for me take 20 minutes. Like as soon as I pull that off my Traeger, I'll turn it up to high and then take vegetables that I just like toss in olive oil and I'll season them with a basic rub, put them in there. But anything like broccoli, asparagus, peppers, cauliflower, anything like that that I cook on there is going to take 20 minutes roughly on high. And the meat is just resting at that point. And then I can literally pull the meat off. If I want to do reverse sear, I can do it just long enough to where that temperature hits the exact number if it hadn't reached that yet. Otherwise, I can just slice it. And according to, you know, the color throughout that, I'll serve it out to everybody according to whether they want something a little more done. You give them one of the end pieces. If people want it less done, you give them the piece in the middle. But typically, if I'm going to let it rest for 20 minutes, I'll pull it at about, you know, 129 degrees, because I like mine at like 135 or so. You like yours a little less. You like yours a little, you know, redder than me. I think you like yours at more like 130 finish, don't you?
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, too, is besides keeping, you know, the basics for seasoning is those thermopens, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have a probe, that's the one thing that I learned from our buddy Chad Ward. Is, you know, when he travels with a good knife and he travels with a probe. And mine's from ThermaWorks. is one I got as a gift someone gave me, and I can tell you that was one of the best things to get because
I have a regular internal thermometer that's it's really cool because I can keep it in the kitchen, and it's got one probe, and then the it registers to a second unit, which you can keep like as a remote. You can keep it far away from the grill. It tells you what's going on. You know, it's like Bluetooth or something or wireless.
Yep.
Steve Rinella actually has a really good cookbook that just came out. I should say that. I was going to have it in here today. He sent it to my house, and it's at my house right now. But it literally just came out.
His are on ninja level.
Yeah. If you want to take things to the next level, I mean, he is he's one of those rare guys that has a television show, a hunting television show, where literally most of the episodes he's cooking something. That's it right now. Meat Eater Fishing Game Cookbook. Okay, it's available November 20th. It's not available to you fucks yet. I already have it. Sorry, folks. But it's really good, though. It's excellent. He sent me a publisher's version that had like just black and white photos, but I just got the full version a couple of days ago, and it's really excellent. But he's got really, really cool recipes and interesting stuff. And if you don't have any wild game, you could always buy bison from supermarkets. Some supermarkets have that, and you could cook that and cook it in the same
way. We're going to bust a bison.
Yeah. And this winter.
Yeah, for good cause.
I'm going to come in and put a fucking bison coat on, son. I'm going to do all my podcasts with a giant bison coat.
You better get an air conditioner in this sucker, dude.
I love bison.
Yeah.
It's delicious
meat. It is awesome. It is awesome. Yeah, you, myself, and our buddy Andy Stump are going to go. For sure, me and Andy, both of our bison are going to be for – that meat is going to have a purpose. Andy and I kind of, through some just talk at a hunting camp, kind of started this thing that we call Free Range American, right? And it's literally a brand that's not really about us. It's just about all these. We have all these friends that just do crazy stuff. And Andy's arguably one of the craziest friends I got.
No, he's the craziest.
Yeah, he's probably the craziest.
He holds the world record for the furthest distance travel in those flying squirrel suits.
Yeah.
He's out of his fucking mind.
He is the craziest. But, one time we were just talking about, just awesome shit people do. And he's like, we just need to motivate people and just talk people into tagging us when they do awesome shit. And so then
The shirt.
Yeah.
The shirt you're wearing.
Yeah.
Do awesome shit.
Yeah.
And so did you guys start this company together, this t-shirt company? Is that the idea?
Yeah. Well, it's more than just that. But yeah, the entire brand the social media stuff is all just – it's based around people that, just tag us with the hashtag do awesome shit, and they show us what they're doing as free-ranging Americans. And, it's anything. It's not just what Andy and I like. I mean, some guys are, firemen that just do crazy stuff. There's people that have some, there's been some MX guys that just post some crazy ass pictures, like Shane Dorian, some of the waves he's on. That's just crazy shit that he's doing.
And what
doing,
are you
right?
going to do with the meat from the bisons?
We're going to, Andy's got a big fifth wheel, calls it the Do Awesome Shit Mobile. And we're going to pull that. We're going to start on the West Coast this spring, and we're going to start where Andy went through Buds, and we're going to hit a base for one of each of the military branches. We're going to try to end at Fort Bragg, where I was born, but we're going to start with the Navy. We're going to end with the Army, and we're going to go to bases, and we're just going to cook wild game out on the Do Awesome Shitmobile. We've got Traegers. Chad Ward's going to be following close behind with some giant rolling Traegers, and we're gonna get these bisons ground up to do some cool bison burgers and stuff like that. And
if you're gonna hit a bunch of military bases, you're gonna need a lot of buffalo.
We're gonna take some buffaloes down, and then we're gonna also have some really cool brands supporting us. But yeah, we're more or less just trying to support the troops, promote clean eating, doing awesome shit, and it's going to be fun. So we're still working out the details, but that's going to be coming. And I'm super thankful of all my friends that are military based or have served for us, and it's just another way that I can do one of the few things I'm good at. You know, I can show people how to shoot archery, or I can cook for them. That's kind of my forte. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a mobile party.
That sounds fun. So when that all goes down, I'll let people know. I'll put it on social media, and we'll talk about it here and let folks know. John Kavanaugh should be here any second now, if he's not already here. I don't know if they're here yet. Are they here yet? Someone's here. They're here. Okay. So we're going to talk to Conor McGregor's coach and George Lockhart, who's Conor's weight-cutting coach, and I think he does his nutrition as well.
Looked awesome. I'll talk to him. He did look dynamite.
While he's getting fucked up, he looks pretty good.
Very true.
Look, it's a fucking hard sport. It's a hard sport. You know, he I'll tell you one thing, though. It would have been nice to talk to him afterwards, because I think he would have been gracious in defeat. I really do.
Yeah,
he has
been
in the
past. I agree.
And I think he was on social media. You know, he said it was a good crack. You know, I mean, maybe we'll get a rematch. You know, he talked a tremendous amount of shit, and it's just hard for people to recover from that.
Yeah,
but part of the game. It's part of the fun.
Part of it.
John Dudley. All right. Knock
See you,
on
man.
TV. You can catch him on Instagram, and you could follow.
N-O-C-K. No K on the front. Yeah. N-O-C-K.
Knock, like Archery Knock. And if you're interested in archery, that's the man to follow, ladies
or
and gentlemen.
Or freerangeamerican.us.
There you go. All right, fuckers. See you soon.